Good morning, and welcome to the Old Mole Variety Hour, on the one day of the year that the powers that be pretend to care about the white supremacist underpinnings of U.S. culture and society. Yes, it's Martin Luther King Jr. Day. The music you hear is Blues for Merle by the Mel Brown Trio playing at Portland's 1905 Jazz Club. Mel Brown is a local jazz drummer and teacher, often considered the godfather of the local jazz scene. You are listening to KBOO Portland. Before I get rolling, I want to remind you that KBOO is your volunteer-powered community radio station, giving voice to every corner of our diverse community. If you can, please support more than half a century of community radio in Portland by going to kboo.fm/give, texting KBOO to 44321, or clicking the donate button on your KBOO app. Today, the Moles are going local. We'll close our show with Denise Morris, who speaks with Jennifer Ruth, co-director with Jan Hocken, about their documentary called The Palestine Exception. The film explores the many ways in which protesters against Israel's genocidal war against Palestinians are being silenced. The tactics employed, I should not have to remind you, have been perfected over decades of effort to silence Black voices. Before that, as your book mole, I review a novel called The Fort Showalter Blues by beloved Portland author, poet, and educator Harold Johnson, who sadly passed away on November 27 of last year at the age of 91. We'll also hear from Desiree Helliger speaking with Lisa Bird and Kent Ford about the destruction of the historic African-American Central Albina neighborhood in the early 1970s to make way for an expansion of Emmanuel Hospital, which never happened. We'll begin the show with some commentary on MLK. All of the music you will hear today is by Black artists, and all but one of them are Portlanders. Now, from your well-read Red. Every year on the third Monday in January, America hosts a Sadie Hawkins-style role reversal where the entire country pretends to celebrate a man whose achievements and values they spent the previous 364 days ignoring, demonizing, and trying to dismantle. Today, your favorite vote suppressors will take a brief respite from disenfranchising Black voters, denying history, and increasing inequality to celebrate a real American hero. That's right, it's MLK Day. That's the opening paragraph to an essay written by Black author Michael Harriet and published in The Guardian January 17, 2022. The article is titled, MLK is Revered Today, But the Real King Would Make White People Uncomfortable. As your well-read Red, I bring you excerpts from the essay. A link to the complete article can be found on the webpage for this show at kboo.fm. Michael Harriet goes on to say, the actual Martin Luther King Jr. who lived and breathed is not the man most people will be honoring today because that Martin Luther King is dead and gone. No, the man upon whom they will heap their performative praise with social media virtual signaling is MLK, a caricature of a man whose likeness has been made palatable for white consumption. like BLM and CRT, the people who King fought against, have now managed to flatten a three-dimensional man to a three-letter chant-worthy phrase worthy of demonization or deification. Whitewashing an entire human being is not as easy as you think, but I understand why they do it. The real Martin Luther King would make white people uncomfortable. Anyone who knows the unwhitened story of Martin Luther King Jr. understands why white-splaining, what MLK would have wanted, is a favorite pastime of politicians and performative, sympathetic social media quote-unquote allies. The average American might get the heebie-jeebies if they knew they were celebrating a radical who challenged systemic racism, supported reparations, and advocated for a universal basic income. Although in death he became one of the most revered figures in U.S. history, for the entirety of the 39 years that King lived and breathed, there wasn't a single day when the majority of white Americans approved of him. In 1966, Gallup measured his approval rating at 63% negative, and a Harris poll found that 50% of whites felt King was hurting the Negro cause of civil rights. By the time he died in 1968, 3 out of 4 white Americans disapproved of him. In the wake of his assassination, 31% of the country felt that he brought it on himself. The sentiments that made him a villain then are still prevalent in America today. When he was alive, King was a walking, talking example of everything this country despises about the quest for black liberation. He railed against police brutality. He reminded the country of its racist past. He scolded the powers that be for income inequality and systemic racism. Not only did he condemn the openly racist opponents of equality, he reminded the legions of whites who were willing to sit idly by while their fellow countrymen were oppressed that they were also oppressors. He who passively accepts evil is as much involved in it as he who helps to perpetrate it, King said. To be fair, King readily admitted that it was his goal to make white people uncomfortable. In his own words, he wanted to, quote, create the kind of tension in society that will help men to rise from the dark depths of prejudice and racism. He went on to explain that nonviolent direct action, King's primary strategy, was an attempt to induce the white community to a point where marginalized people's desperate cries could no longer be ignored. Yet the new, more compassionate America is just as intolerant when Black Lives Matter demonstrators flood into the streets to protest police brutality. Of course, if teaching Black history wasn't criminalized as critical race theory, more people might know that the Selma to Montgomery marchers' original intent was to confront their governor about police brutality. Days before a white supremacist put a bullet in his face, King said, "The first thing I would like to mention is that there must be a recognition on the part of everybody in this nation that America is still a racist country. Now, however unpleasant that sounds, it is the truth." End quote. That's why, despite what people who cherry-pick quotes from the I Have a Dream speech would have you believe, King has never suggested that white people should be judged by the content of their character and not by the color of their skin. In fact, he regularly judged white people to explain the insanity of white supremacy. Quote, "In their relations with Negroes, white people discovered that they had rejected the very center of their own ethical professions," King wrote in 1956. "They could not face the triumph of their lesser instincts and simultaneously have peace within, and so they rationalized, insisting that the unfortunate Negro, being less than human, deserved and even enjoyed second-class status." End quote. Now that King is dead and gone, leaders like Ted Cruz and Ron DeSantis will sing hosannas for MLK while demonizing Black Lives Matter and critical race theory as Marxist, un-American race baiting. It is no coincidence that Alabama's Governor George Wallace described King as, quote, perhaps the most dangerous racist in America today. Even after his death, conservative leaders sought to sully King's legacy by erasing the prospect of a holiday honoring him. Reverend King's motives are misrepresented, wrote then Ohio Senator John Ashbrook. He sought not to work through the law, but around it, end quote. And the conservatives won. They only agreed to honor King's legacy after enough time had passed to sufficiently whitewash the radical who unapologetically fought for liberty and justice for all. The people who continue to protect broken systems of criminal justice, education, and democracy might not necessarily hate King, but they do not love him or anything he stood for. The polling data proves it. Historical facts prove it. The bits of blood and bone that stained the balcony outside of a Memphis hotel proves it. More importantly, the fact that Black Americans are still fighting the same battles against voter suppression, inequality, and the right to have a dream almost 54 years after his death is the most accurate measuring rod of what this nation thinks about Martin Luther King. Perhaps that is the most uncomfortable fact of all. I've been reading a lightly edited version of an article by Michael Harriet published in The Guardian titled MLK is Revered Today, but the real king would make white people uncomfortable. That was bassist and vocalist Esperanza Spalding with a tune called I Know You Know. Before that, I was reading from an article about MLK by Michael Harriet. You are listening to KBOO Portland. We turn now to Desiree Hellegers, who recently checked in with Lisa Bird of the Emmanuel Displaced Persons Association II and Black Panther co-founder Kent Ford. In the early 70s, the historic Central Albina neighborhood was essentially razed to make way for an expansion of Emmanuel Hospital. 50 years later, survivors and descendants are seeking compensation for the forced evictions and demolitions of Black property. Here's Desiree with Lisa Bird, who goes by the single name Bird, and Kent Ford.
In December 2022, when the civil rights lawsuit was filed against the city of Portland, Emmanuel Hospital and Prosper Portland, previously known as the Portland Development Commission, or PDC, the suit garnered considerable press attention locally and even some nationally. The suit was brought by the firm of Ashley Albies, along with the Oregon Law Center and Oregon Legal Aid. This past week, I spoke with Bird, who is an organizer with the Emmanuel Displaced Persons Association II, or EDPA II, as well as a plaintiff in the case about the Central Albina neighborhood. And I also spoke with Kent Ford, co-founder of the Portland chapter of the Black Panther Party, who, though not a plaintiff, lived and worked in the neighborhood where he helped launch and support the Black Panther dental and medical clinics, which narrowly averted demolition in the early 70s. For a crash course in the history of Central Albina in the late 60s and early 70s, I highly recommend Mr. Ford's Power to the People Black Panther Legacy Tours of Albina. Notably, both Bird and Kent Ford spoke briefly, at least, about the role that Ira Keller played in the gentrification and displacement in Central Albina. Ira Keller was the chair of the Portland Development Commission from 1958 to 1972. In July, the city celebrated the reopening of the Ira Keller Fountain in Keller Fountain Park at Southwest 3rd Avenue and Clay Street. And in October, the city committed millions in funding for major renovations to the Keller Auditorium in the same block. According to a press release issued by the legal team, again including Legal Aid Services of Oregon, Oregon Law Center, and the firm of Ashley Albies, quote, Starting in the late 1950s and into the early 1970s, the city, Prosper Portland, then PDC, and Legacy Emmanuel acted in concert to forcibly displace hundreds of families from their homes and businesses in central Albina. Between 1971 and 1973, the PDC demolished an estimated 188 properties, 158 of which were residential and 30 of which were commercial. And again, I'm reading from a press release by the legal team. Those properties were inhabited by approximately 88 families, 83 individuals, 23 businesses, 9 rental businesses, and 4 churches or community organizations. Of the 171 reported forcibly displaced households, 74% were Black, many of whom owned their homes free and clear. Again, that was from the press release, and I'm just going to read some from the text of the lawsuit itself. The text of the lawsuit, I think, is a really teachable text. It provides important insights into Portland history, and I'm just going to read a little section of it. So this case is about the intentional destruction of a thriving Black community in central Albina under the pretense of facilitating a hospital expansion that never happened. Plaintiffs are 26 Black survivors and descendants of families whose homes were destroyed by the defendants, as well as an organization formed to help them seek justice. This horribly racist chapter from Portland's past has not closed, causing plaintiffs continuing harm in the form of an ongoing public nuisance. Further, the unjust enrichment of defendants flowing directly from the destructions of plaintiffs' former neighborhood continues to this day and will continue into the future unless abated. In addition, recently discovered information long concealed by defendants shows the contours of a conspiracy between defendants to deprive plaintiffs of their civil rights. And that recently discovered information, then the suit goes on to identify, quote, shows that urban renewal and blight were pretext for defendants' real motive, a racist desire to remove Black people from the economically valuable neighborhood of central Albina. Over the decades and in recent years, the city, PDC, and Emmanuel have profited from this stolen land. Far from removing blight, defendants' concerted actions created a public nuisance that to this day has not been remedied and is causing plaintiffs continuing intergenerational harm. And I just want to make clear that Bird in particular was unable to say
much about the lawsuit, given that it is ongoing.
And I do think it needs to be stated that Emmanuel's involvement in this documented attack on Black wealth and workers constituted an unconscionable violation of the Hippocratic Oath, and it had to have had profound intergenerational health impacts on the families that were displaced, many of whom made use of the Black Panther Health Clinic. Because even before they were displaced, many could not afford health insurance or the cost of being seen by doctors at Emmanuel. Here's Bird.
Was a thriving and prosperous community where people helped one another, where the experts were right there in your community. You didn't have to leave out for anything that you needed. Was self-sufficient, where it was, you know, it had its own economic base, its own political sort of power, social capital within, all within the confines of that space that we call Central Albina. And so it was a beautiful community where people felt loved. It was a community that accepted everyone. You had everything, a good, bad, or indifferent, and that's what community is. And so it was a platform for future. It was a platform and foundation for future prosperity. There were over 500 businesses that ran along Williams during that time, and in a very short period of time, too. I think like within 6 years of people having to move from Vanport to Central Albina, Williams Corridor, there were so many businesses within a 6 year period. The spirit of entrepreneurship was so high. It was just beautiful. When you talk to people who actually grew up there, it brings them to tears. And it's totally understandable because when you just sort of imagine, had that prosperity been left alone, what that community could have been, you know, it's heartbreaking.
And you're making, mm-hmm. I think, some interesting connections to
the Ira Keller, the new Ira Keller Auditorium that's being built, right? Because Ira Keller was the first head of the Portland Development Commission. You know, the implications of now having this auditorium named after Ira Keller, a new auditorium for Ira Keller.
I can speak to the history of Ira Keller and him being the head of PDC. You're correct. Ira Keller was the first person to run PDC, and a lot of neighborhoods were demolished in the spirit of urban renewal under his leadership, and the Central Alabama demolition falls under that as well. So the Ira Keller Auditorium is named after Ira Keller, who ultimately was responsible for the demolition of our family homes.
Is there any organizing afoot to kind of call attention to that connection?
Not that I know of. We know that the serial forced removal of Black people in the city of Portland is something that occurs even to this day. And people, there is a high concentration of Black people in the poorest area of Multnomah County, which is Outer East. And it's not just me talking, those are stats. Those are, you know, that's what the data tells us. But people have relocated everywhere. People, you know, people are relocated everywhere, Desiree.
And there also would have been people forced out by the introduction of the freeway entrance there as well, right?
The Minnesota Freeway, the Unthank Park, that's not one that we talk about, you know, very often, but Unthank Park, Lloyd Center, Memorial Coliseum, the Blanchard Building. I mean, yes, there's serial forced removal of Black people in the city of Portland is not an unfamiliar or unknown phenomena.
And here we are talking about, again, an I-5 expansion. Yeah, and clearly these were dynamics that weren't unique to Portland. They were kind of a nationwide attack on Black wealth and on Black workers.
Oh, definitely, particularly during the 60s and 70s when urban renewal was the thing of the day to, you know, and across this country, Black prosperity, political capital, social capital, all of those things were disrupted because of urban renewal. Central Alabama was such a ideal, like so many communities around the country during the 60s and 70s. It was really what the American dream is all about. You had community, you had love, you had people working together, supporting one another. You had the idea of a future, and people were working to fulfill that ideal of a future. They were thinking ahead, and I think that is the element that I always go back to. When I think about this history, I think about what happened in Portland and indeed all over this country. It was the fulfillment of a future. That's what I've latched on to. People wanted to have an economic base for their children, for their grandchildren. They wanted a home for their children, for their grandchildren and beyond. They wanted, you know, a strong economic base right where they lived. It was for the future. It was about the future, an improved future, a better future, a prosperous future, a future that would allow generations to build on prior successes.
And here's Kent Ford.
Well, I remember back in 1971, 72. When it all first started, you know, and Armenian displacement, and we had a new administration in the city, new Goldsmith administration, you know, but the gentrification had been taking place under the Trunk administration. He was the mayor, you know, and he I think he had some heart problems and passed away. You know, the new freeway there, the Fremont Bridge was going in and everything, and it was a thriving community down in there with factories, businesses, private homes, and it was all around the hospital there. It was total gentrification for the hospital, you know. We didn't know it at the time. You know, everybody was moving, and PDC set up a trailer when I remember as if it were yesterday about the trailer being on Emmanuel Hospital property. And they were recruiting people from the neighborhood to work for the Portland Development Commission, you know. And then I remember the American Friends Service. They were on Rodney and Morrison Street. They had a house there, a two-story house there. And the guy's name was Bob Nelson. He was with the American Friends Service, you know. And he went right along with it and made like he was for it, you know, the good neoliberal transition guys, you know. I'm for you, but... you know, I'm really pulling with the city and stuff like that. That's pretty much what happened. And the next thing you know, the factories start closing, things start moving out from pipe fitting plants, paint shops, mattresses, places, restaurants, Chinese restaurants, Louis, right there, Russell, and Williams. And then you had the stores, you know, what we call convenience, the regular stores, people shopped there for decades. Barbecues, you know, one particular barbecue place I remember really well, Scotty's Barbecue, you know, where old time we had some of the best barbecue in town. And he moved out, you know, and it was what was so nice about the community was multiracial, multicultural, you know, Asians, blacks. You know, whites, and it was really a multicultural neighborhood. Nobody told us about the treachery that was involved in it at the time, you know. We found this out years later, and everybody got displaced and had to move out. So I got a call one day at the health clinic there, and the guy met with us, and he gave us 2 weeks to get out. The next thing I know, PDC them broke into the health clinic the next morning and moving the stuff out. So that's where we moved the health clinic around the corner of Sacramento and Williams. And it was, you know, apartment houses, private homes, and it was a thriving neighborhood down in there. Good people, really beautiful people.
Mr. Ford on Ira Keller.
Yeah, I never did actually meet him. I used to read about him. And yeah, he was out of West Point. Staunch racist and white supremacist.
Many thanks to Bird, an organizer with EDPA2, and also a plaintiff in the civil rights lawsuit against the City of Portland, Emmanuel Hospital, and Prosper Portland, formerly known as the PDC. And thanks also to Mr. Kent Ford, co-founder of the Portland chapter of the Black Panther Party. This has been Desiree Helgers for the Olmo Variety Hour.
Just heard local band Down North featuring Jabril Jimmy James Williams with a tune called Heartbreaker. Before that, Desiree Helgers was speaking with Bird and Kent Ford about the destruction of the thriving Black community of the Central Albina District in the 1970s. You are listening to KBOO Portland. It's the early 1950s. The Korean War has just ended, and Joe Birdsong is in love. A teenager who has grown up in a small town in eastern Washington, he's out one evening walking with his sweetheart, and he describes it this way. Her face played me Artie Shaw's Frenesi, Mr. B singing My Foolish Heart, John Ray doing Walking My Baby Back Home. I heard Fur Elise, trumpet fanfares, all jumbled together, pulling this way and that way inside my chest. We walked in step with all the music between us from 3 years together in orchestra. I put each foot down with care so my walk was smooth, not bouncing, and I didn't swing my shoulders. And walking along like this with Sylvia was almost as good as holding hands. Our breath created clouds that we walked through. My ears were on alert for sounds behind us, and my eyes stayed peeled for anything in front of us. End quote. Of course, Joe and Sylvia don't hold hands. Of course, Joe's eyes and ears are peeled for others, because Sylvia is white and Joe is black. Sure enough, a policeman pulls over, bullies Sylvia into the car, and whisks her away from the black kid who has strayed out of place. Joe Birdsong is the protagonist of the novel Fort Showalter Blues, written by local author, poet, and beloved teacher Harold Johnson, who passed at the age of 91 on November 27, 2024. The novel, in part autobiographical, tells the story of a young black man who is perpetually out of place. He's at once too black and not black enough. His skin is too dark and his hair too kinky, but he also talks like a white man. And once, when he enters a mess hall full of black and white soldiers, he realizes with dismay that he can't tell one black from the other, while the white men look like individuals. He's at once colorblind and acutely aware of color in a way that penetrates to his very bones. He forms his friendships based not on race, but on a common love of music and literature. But he experiences his blackness every moment of every day in the ways that people respond to him, and fear is a big part of his daily life. Quote, "This trickle of terror memory way back in the woods of my psyche, full of members castrated, lynched, getting the Emmett Till treatment for doing less than nothing with ignorant white women down south," end quote. Burdened with these contradictions, Joe Birdsong is having a tough time finding his way in the world. He completes a degree in English at Portland State University, plays classical music on his trumpet, and gets hired on as one of the first blacks to teach in the Portland public schools. He marries a young black woman, fathers a child, cheats on his wife with a white woman, and gets a divorce. Then he is drafted and sent to fictional Fort Showalter in El Paso, Texas. His first day there, dying of thirst on a scorching day, he tries to buy an icy cold Coca-Cola at a USO for service members. Three white soldiers jump him, viciously kick his butt, and toss him out. The local USO is not for black soldiers. This event sets a whole lot in motion that Joe is not prepared for. Thinking of the white guys, Joe muses, quote, "The one from Mississippi especially gets on my nerves, and I regularly have shocking thoughts related to his destruction. Never felt so awful toward another person, but at the same time, the idea of pulverizing the mother effer is delicious," end quote. Three fellow black soldiers, whom Joe calls the heavies and who frighten him, catch wind of the racist incident and want to take revenge. But even with his vengeful fantasies, Joe has no stomach for the kind of revenge they propose. Meanwhile, Joe concentrates on his horn, becomes part of a mixed-race community of musicians, and slowly becomes a worthy practitioner of jazz. But he continues to mess up in ways that young men are prone to. These mess-ups do not escape the attention of Joe's dead father, a preacher, who repeatedly appears on a cavalry horse before his chagrined son. The old man quotes scripture by way of pointing out Joe's considerable foolishness and bad choices. Quote, "Vengeance is mine, saith the Lord," he quotes to Joe. "Vengeance don't belong to man. Revenge don't get people no place, just treading a whole lot of sad water," end quote. An older black woman takes Joe aside to tell him about being serious. "Listen, baby," she says, "the thing to keep in mind is if you know something is wrong for you, don't do it." But a lot has to happen before Joe even understands what she's talking about. Fort Showalter Blues is a story of revenge and acceptance, of discovering one's unique identity, of learning how to navigate a world full of evil and temptation without selling your soul. It's about being young and black and male in a society that has little love and lots of treachery for young, black, and male. Harold Johnson was a poet and a musician himself, and the passages he writes are rich with rhythm and metaphor and imagery. The book, in that way, is a delight to read. That was Clifford Brown stomping at the Savoy, one of Joe Birdsong's favorite bebop artists and trumpet player. Before that, I was talking about Fort Showalter Blues by local writer and teacher Harold Johnson, who passed away in November of 2024. You are listening to KBOO Portland. The campus voices that rose up in protest against Israel's genocidal war in the Middle East have been largely silenced. How that happened and how the history of the region is being effectively erased and rewritten is the subject of local filmmaker Jan Hawkins' latest documentary, The Palestine Exception, which is co-directed by PSU Professor of Film Studies Jennifer Ruth. The film will be showing at Cinema 21 this coming Sunday, January 26 at 4 p.m., followed by a panel discussion. Here's Denise Morris speaking with Jennifer Ruth about the film.
Good morning. The Palestine Exception is a Portland-based documentary film directed by PSU faculty Jan Hawken and Jennifer Ruth. The film features professors and students as they join calls for a ceasefire and divestment from companies that do business with Israel and face waves of crackdown from administrators, the media, the police, and politicians. Scholars from diverse disciplines explain what is at stake in these protests and why so many young people identify with the Palestinian cause. The documentary unfolds as a story of college campuses as sites of both rebellion and repression, places where personal and collective histories converge in unexpected ways. This morning, I talk with co-director Jennifer Ruth about the film and responses so far at screenings on campuses across the U.S. Jennifer Ruth is a professor in the School of Film at Portland State University and co-author of two books on academic freedom with Michael Berube, including It's Not Free Speech, Race, Democracy, and the Future of Academic Freedom, that was published in 2022. In May 2024, Jennifer Ruth joined co-director Jan Hawken on the Old Mole Variety Hour to talk about attacks on academic freedom. She had this to say about the Palestine exception.
It's a pretty well-known phrase, the Palestine exception to academic freedom and free speech in academic freedom circles. It's widely used, even by people who are not particularly invested in human rights or justice for Palestinians. And the common use of the phrase speaks to the wide acknowledgement that speech and scholarship around Israel-Palestine is handled differently in the U.S. than other speech and scholarship, and that Palestine and advocacy for Palestine has long served as the limit case for acceptable political advocacy. The phrase draws our attention to the fact that while the law might theoretically protect the right to advocate for Palestinian freedom, powerful social forces will not only punish those who do, they will also punish those who don't act quickly enough to crush pro-Palestinian advocates. And we've seen this since October. Suspensions and expulsions of students who spoke out, the revocation of job offers that were made once students speak out on behalf of Palestine, the doxing campaigns in New York, calling people who have advocated for stopping the genocide anti-Semites. We've seen the Palestine exception in practice over the last half year.
This Sunday, January 26th at 4 p.m., the Palestine Exception film will make its theatrical debut at Cinema 21. The screening at Cinema 21 will be followed by a panel and a Q&A moderated by Marlene Ide, producer and psychology faculty member at Portland Community College, panelists Stephanie Wahab, professor of social work at PSU, and Hannah Alsgal, a Portland State University alum featured in the film, along with the film's directors.
Good morning, Jennifer Ruth. Welcome to KBOO.
Thanks for having me.
I want to, again, congratulate you and the crew. The Palestine Exception is a terrific film, and it is great to have you back on the Old Mole to talk again about this really important film post-completion and leading up to its theatrical debut on Sunday, January 26th. That's 4 p.m. at Cinema 21. Tickets for this screening are available online. There'll be a panel discussion to follow, and we'll give more details at the end of the program about that screening. So Jennifer, I wanted to start with how you came to take up this project. You co-directed the film, The Palestine Exception, with Jan Hawken. She's Professor Emeritus of Psychology at PSU. and a documentary filmmaker. She's also one of our very own Old Mole Collective members. So start there. Tell us how you came together on this and took this project up.
Yeah, so I am a professor in the School of Film at Portland State, and I was doing a class that had a fair number of documentaries, and we have both production classes and criticism theory. We call them film studies classes, but we like to create bridges between the two sides of the program wherever possible. And I knew about Jan's work as a documentarian, so I invited her to my class. And I do work, in addition to writing about literature and film, I do work on academic freedom and higher ed issues. And when the Red State attacks on critical race theory, when the legislation was getting passed around so-called divisive concepts, I got very involved in that battle because it's a, you know, an attack on academic freedom, saying what can be taught and what can't. And they were going after faculty who taught critical race theory. So I got very involved in that fight. And I reached out to Jan and asked if she'd be interested in making a documentary based in Texas, because everyone was focused on Florida, but interesting stuff was happening in Texas. And she said yes, and we started to work. But then after 10/7, we really quickly pivoted because the Palestine exception began to be enforced. People were only supposed to, of course, reference the hostages and what happened on 10/7 and not speak up about the disproportionate war violence and the collective punishment, or even teach about. Then, you know, tensions escalated really fast, and the propaganda machines around trying to demean students and faculty who use terms like settler colonialism, trying to erase some of the history there and not talk about it. So we pivoted and started to work on this, and we wanted to talk to scholars, student activists too, but scholars who could really sort of educate the public about the Palestine issue.
It seems that the student movements really bubbled to the top. We'll talk a little bit more about that. But as the film has been screening on campuses, how has the Palestine exception been received?
Yeah, so just quickly to mention, this is a kind of love letter to the student movement. It was the encampments, it was the protests, it was the die-ins that students organized across the country. And you know, if you were just reading some press outlets, you would think it was only the most elite Ivy universities. That's not true. All across the country, students were organizing to speak out about the genocide. And so this is a kind of love letter to them, and that they knew what they were doing and they were on the right side of history. But we couldn't really focus so much on students because they're under so much scrutiny, and they were under so much scrutiny last year and being called up on charges of anti-Semitism, disciplinary investigations. So while we do have some footage of student protest encampments, and we have some student activists who felt courageous enough to be interviewed, we have a lot of scholars. But it's student groups mostly that seem to be really excited to screen the film. So the reception from students has been really gratifying because, you know, you make a film and you think it's a love letter to the students, but you have to prepare to be told, you did this wrong, you misrepresented this, you just... But that's not been the case. We've had a really, really warm reception from students where they feel really validated and recognized, and they're exhausted, and they're, you know, some of them are under suspension, some of them are dealing with fines. And so this kind of helps give them some of their energy back. And so that's been really a very great feeling.
That's awesome. I love to hear that. It's a really nice way of putting it too, as well. Giving some love for what it means to put yourself out in that situation for young people who are at risk of losing a lot, really.
Oh, yeah. What's kind of beautiful about the students is when I start to mention, you know, they may not be able to graduate and they are student debt, and or they may have a job offer revoked, like we saw at NYU when some of the law school students found law firms revoked their offers. So the stakes are really high for the students. And one of the most amazing things about them is every time I will mention that, they will say, yes, but that doesn't compare to the scholasticide and the deaths in Gaza. They have a really amazing sense of perspective.
Glad you said that, because I would have said the same, that there is perspective there. We can go down rabbit holes about what it means to acknowledge your privilege or revoke it of your own accord, but that's absolutely true, that by comparison, what's being lost is telling us a story about where we are and about why the Palestine exception is so devastating. Let's move back to this question about the screenings, because I can't imagine it's been all rosy. You're about to embark on some maybe less controlled environments, and I'm curious about how that's been in terms of scheduling screenings in places that are not on campuses.
Right. The film was just finished at the end of November, and we did a couple of campuses in December. We did PSU in late November, and then in December, we went to Duke, UNC Chapel Hill, and Brown. And it was interesting at those places to learn of slight, not slight, actually, big differences in the groups that had been active in speaking up against the genocide. That was very interesting. So, for example, at UNC Chapel Hill, students really drove it. At Duke, the faculty were organizing the screening, and the faculty were saying, our students are pretty passive. And it was also interesting to be to learn that, for example, that Duke was starting to actually use that as a kind of pitch for recruiting students. We are a safe campus, right? Because of the whole misrepresentation, misinformation around danger and threats for it during pro-Palestinian protests. So that was very interesting, but as far as our reception goes, it was all warm and welcoming on all of those fronts. We are about to start to have new kinds of venues, community groups that maybe rent a theater. And then we also have the Cinema 21. So we're about to sort of embark, like you say, on a broader audience that we may experience more pushback, more people coming for Q&As to precisely to accuse us of being anti-Israel, the film of being anti-Israel. So for example, we're really, really pleased that Cinema 21 is showing this. They have a poster about it outside and inside. They've used our trailer alongside trailers for the movies that they're going to screen. So they've been really out front with it, and they haven't shied away from it at all. And they have received complaints. They have received questions like, is this an advocacy film? Is this an anti-Israel film? And it's really heartwarming that, because it is a big risk. It is a big risk for a small business or a community organization that depends on a broad support. It is a big risk. That's why it's a Palestine exception, because lobbying groups and different organizations can come together and can do emails and petitions and all kinds of things to make it hard for these small businesses and community organizations. We're really grateful to Cinema 21. And there are other theaters that people are looking to rent and theaters who are interested in showing it. And Cinema 21 will be the first to sort of lay the groundwork for that and show that it can be done.
That's great. We'll have to make sure that we encourage people to support Cinema 21 and others who may come along and do the same. In terms of the organizing, in terms of the movements themselves, students have returned to campus. There's not a slowing down, it seems, of these organizing efforts. What are you seeing out there in terms of how those strategies, tactics may be changing, shifting to battle against some of the repression that they experienced last year? What are you seeing out there?
Well, I am seeing some slowing down because they took so many hits at the over late spring and summer. So a lot of the disciplinary investigations started up at late spring. The consequences, the unfair, unjust consequences for protesting, they became clear at the end of spring. So there's a lot of hesitation, but there's also a determination, and I think there's also an intention to keep focusing on divestment as an issue. And there's also a determination to not stop, but there's all kinds of new rules. For example, they enforce rules around time, manner, place. Campuses enforce these rules in a much more dramatic fashion than they did last year. And actually, they did it in ways last year too that they hadn't done previously, which is the Palestine exception, to enforce rules that are kind of technicalities or formalities, enforce them in the case of some protests, but not others. So that had already happened, but now they're broadcasting their time, manner, place restrictions everywhere, getting that in front of students' eyes. In some places, I'm sure they're making students consent to these time, manner, place restrictions through some kind of form that they have to sign. And it's things like you can't use a bullhorn, you have to get prior permission for anything over a certain number of people, you can only use certain spaces. So it makes it really, really difficult. So, for example, some students did a die-in recently at Portland State, and it was incredibly moving because they'd simply just read names of Palestinians who had been killed. Many of them were between 0 and 3 years old. And so it was heartbreaking. They had a bullhorn and it was inside a building and they were not super loud. And I know they got admonished for the bullhorn. It's not clear to me whether or not there's going to be any further consequences. They're more trepidatious. And I do think that faculty need to step up a little more this year because students have borne the brunt. On the other hand, at the end of last year, only one tenured faculty that we were aware of had been fired for reposting things that were critical of Zionism. Now, Catherine Franke, whose case had been ongoing all of last year, she's at Columbia, I believe. She's been pushed out, and she has a statement on the AAUP blog about being pushed out. And so faculty dismissals are becoming more visible, and that, of course, is going to chill faculty speech. And of course, last year, those were the two tenured cases, but there were many non-tenure track faculty who were not rehired, were not renewed, or were even taken out of the classroom mid-quarter, mid-semester. So it's a tough time. I think people are also bracing for what is it going to be like under this new Department of Education led by a wrestling business executive under the Trump administration. There's a lot of unknowns.
Yeah, I don't know really what to make of that. And I think the last time we talked, we had just finished the election. It's deepened in my brain a little bit more. So, well,
Exactly. Yeah.
with our last minute here, I wanted to just have you let folks know, other than Cinema 21, where might screenings be happening locally? I know that the film is being shown more widely, and folks can go to the Palestine Exception website for lots of information, including articles, videos, talks. It's a really fabulous website, so I encourage people to go check it out. But let us know, where else folks might be able to see the film.
Oh, so I guess I misspoke when I said it's only been campuses until the Cinema 21, because actually we had a wonderful virtual screening that was run by the Palestine Museum out of Connecticut. And this director, he's very well connected, been in the movement for a long time, has a huge reach. Many progressive Jewish people come to his talks and he shows different films. He has an exhibition in London right now, and he's going to be screening the film on a loop. It's art about Palestine or art by Palestinians, but he's actually going to be screening the loop in London, the film on a loop. He had two virtual screenings, but going forward, we are having one. We're excited about one at Hunter College in New York, part of the CUNY system, because Hunter students and Hunter faculty are featured in the film. Those were the first footage that we shot. So it feels like coming full circle. The People's Forum in New York is also going to be showing it. And then there's lots of campus screenings in the mix and community organizations, JVP chapters, both on campuses and off. Churches have shown interest, have submitted requests. So we're just trying to keep up with the requests that come in and help people organize screenings, which is really gratifying. One of the things that's coming up, there's a Coalition for Action in Higher Ed, which is a group that I've been a part of. It's about all the attacks on higher education. But the Coalition of Higher Ed Steering Committee asked that our film be the kickoff for a week of events around the attacks on higher ed. So I love the way that the Palestine Exception will be centered at the very beginning of a week of activities and actions and other kinds of events around standing up for academic freedom and free speech.
That's great. It's so good to hear. Jennifer Ruth, thank you so much for joining us this morning on The Old Mole for KBOO Radio, and good luck out there. And I hope to actually find my way to a screening soon.
I'd love to see you at Cinema 21.
All right, I'm going to try.
Okay.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye.
Thanks to Jennifer Ruth, co-director with Jan Hocken of the Palestine Exception film. A reminder that this film will make its theatrical debut at Cinema 21 this coming Sunday, January 26th at 4 p.m. We recommend that you get tickets online in advance. The film will be followed by a panel and a Q&A moderated by Marlene Eide, producer and psychology faculty member at Portland Community College, and panelist Stephanie Wahab, professor of social work at PSU, Hannah Alsgall, a PSU alum, who is featured in the film, and the film directors. They'll all be there to chat with you about the film. Again, get tickets online in advance. It's really worth getting out and seeing this film. Thank you for joining us this morning. I'm Denise Morris for the Old Mole Variety Hour.
I hear those tickets are going fast. Don't miss this opportunity to see the Palestine Exception. And that's it for our Martin Luther King Jr. special. Thanks to Moles, Desiree Helligers, and Denise Morris for their contributions, and a special thanks to our guests, Lisa Bird, Kent Ford, and Jennifer Ruth. And a shout-out to the staff at your community radio station, KBOO Portland, for all of their hard work to keep us going. I'm Patricia Kohlberg, and I've been your host for the hour. Join us again next Monday at 9 a.m. for more reviews, views, and interviews from the ground up. Until then, stay safe and especially stay active. We have lots of work ahead of us in the coming 4 years. I'm going to leave you with music by the local band King Youngblood called Heavy Handed. Thanks for listening. What I mean, change my mind and my dreams. You don't know.